This is NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. 19 years ago today, in the state of Washington, Mount St. Helens erupted with nearly twice the force of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Here's how the eruption was reported at the time.
It just started blowing, and it just looked like the whole top of the mountain just exploded into one black ball, and it just kept growing and growing.
A searing hot flow of ash, gas, and rocks poured from the summit crater and rushed down the mountainside. As the flow reached timberline, trees were pushed over like toothpicks.
And everything is covered with either white or gray ash. There are tree falls as much as 15 miles away from the top of the mountain.
Mudslides have already created a 20-foot high wall of water on one river. Evacuations of nearby towns are continuing.
All of the roads in eastern Washington are closed. Schools are closed. Airports are closed. Mail service has been stopped.
Five people are now reported dead as a result of this morning's eruption.
Some of these people were just killed in their tracks. They were just killed right on the spot. They must have just literally had their lives snuffed right out from inside of them. There was just never a chance.
Voices from 1980, including NPR's Howard Berkus. The eruption of Mount St. Helens was one of the biggest stories of Morning Edition's first year on the air. To mark our 20th year, we sent Howard back to Mount St. Helens to talk with some of the people affected by the eruption.
My return to Mount St. Helens began in Portland, Oregon, in the hillside Victorian home of writer Ursula Le Guin.
This is my study. This is where I work, yeah.
We last talked 19 years ago, when this tiny study was plastered with sketches of Mount St. Helens. They're gone now, but the lure of the mountain persists.
When you live with a very beautiful mountain, and they did call it Little Fuji, right out 45 miles away out your window, in the intervals of having wonderful ideas for what to write about, you might be staring out the window, and there is this lovely thing. And it's a presence in your life.
Even after its snow-white slopes turned black with ash from the early and small eruptions of 1980, even after the cataclysmic blast that May. Later that year, Le Guin drove a red VW bus into what is called the blast zone.
We saw it before anything had regrown at all. It was just the way it was. And there wasn't anything in the vaporized zone. There wasn't anything. There was ash. And sometimes a bird flying overhead. You couldn't help but think of things like London and Dresden, the bombings from the Second World War, but the scale was just a lot larger than that. It was just devastation on this majestic scale.
And horror on a smaller, more human scale. Le Guin wrote about that, reflecting on a car she saw on that trip, the remnant of a family caught in the eruption while visiting their mine.
The car sits tiny and most terrible. The beer cans in the back imploded. The car sits glassless, rusting, flattened out a bit. Authority has put a chain link fence around it to keep out looters or to hold the horror in. The car sits where they parked it when they went up to their mine, under the big dark trees in ferns and huckleberry, the thrushes singing maybe, sunlight in the needles of the firs. As I went walking one morning so early, as I went walking one morning of May, it was a long day, longer than any other day, a labyrinth from dark to way into the dark, by way of dust, by way of fire, by way of ash, by way of rain. A maze of the bones of children and the bones of deer.
Writer Ursula Le Guin. Others remember with photographs and slides, like those Ty Kearney projects on a screen in his Vancouver, Washington living room.
Apologize for the squeaky old projector. It needs an oil job.
The projector may be squeaky, but the slides are stunning, showing the actual moments of eruption. First, there's the massive landslide, the whole north slope breaking loose. Then an explosion of pumice and ash, a sideways blast, followed by black clouds billowing skyward. Kearney and his wife Mariano witnessed the eruption from their ham radio observation post, where they monitored the mountain for the state.
I thought we were far enough away that I didn't feel like we were in danger and had to leave. But after Ty shot that last one, the seventh picture, where he could see the black cloud lowering into the South Fork, then he got real nervous because he was afraid that cloud would get us. I got in the van, the back of the van, and the radio was back there. When we got farther down, I think they asked about Jerry. And I said, Jerry's in the cloud.
Jerry's in the cloud, and it's going right through him.
Jerry Martin manned a ham radio post even closer, and a mile ahead of him was a young federal geologist named David Johnston. This is how Jerry Martin began his final report.
Oh, I just felt an earthquake. Now we've got an eruption down here. Now we got a big slide coming off. The slide is coming off of the west slope. Now we got a whole great big eruption out of the crater. And we got another that opened up on the west side, a whole west side, northwest side, a slide down.
Ty and Mariana Kearney were listening.
He says, it's got the trailer and car in front of me. You know, that would have been David Johnston he was talking about. He says, it's going to get me too. I'm going to back out of here. And that's about the last thing we ever heard.
Mariana and I say that this event happened yesterday. I mean, it's vivid.
It divides our lives, you know, and I think that this event divides a lot of people's lives out here. Did something happen before or did it happen afterwards? You can figure out sometimes when certain things happen just by remembering the dates of the eruption.
The Kearneys were able to drive to safety, but seven people died in a canyon nearby. Mike Moore also escaped. He was camped 13 miles from the mountain with his wife and two young daughters. He has stunning photographs.
This is not a black and white photograph. That's what our world looked like when we emerged the next day. Totally black and white. You couldn't see color anywhere unless you were wearing it. And our major color that we saw was our tent when we camped that night after trying about 18 hours to get out and not being able to make it.
The Moors endured something biblical, blinding flashes of lightning, deafening thunder, and ash so thick it turned day to night. They breathed through dampened socks until the ashfall eased, then climbed over and under fallen trees, gray and ghost-like, until exhausted. A helicopter crew found them the next day, but others near them did not survive.
To me, the most pathetic story is of a gentleman that was in the area of Ryan Lake, and he was a huge guy. He was in extremely good physical shape, had the intelligence to wrap himself up in his sleeping bag and start walking out. And he made it 14 miles before he finally collapsed and went to sleep. And the body was found with his lungs and his trachea and his mouth and his nose just filled with ash. What kind of death is that? Our situation doesn't compare to what other people went through.
In all, 57 people were killed, some in places thought to be safe, because Mount St. Helens surprised scientists in the way it erupted. It's surprising them still. I'm Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Tomorrow, nature's recovery at Mount St. Helens. It's 11 minutes before the hour.